Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Hi, good evening. Nice to see many of you here. My name's Henry Overman. I'm a professor at LSE and one of the editors of the Economica Journal who are hosting this evening's COSE lecture I'll be chairing. Welcome to all of you, both in the room and online. We're looking forward to an interesting discussion this evening. A couple of logistics. We're not expecting a fire alarm. If there is one, someone will tell us where to go, I hope. Mobile phones to silent, please. Apparently we're happy for you to keep them on nowadays so that you can social media. I will introduce Ed shortly. He'll speak for about 45 minutes, 50 minutes, I think we agreed, and then there'll be 25 minutes for questions. We'll take questions both in the theatre and online. For those of you that are here in the theatre, there'll be a mic. Please wait for the mic. Tell us who you are. For those of you who are online, you need to ask questions via the Q&A function and someone will moderate them to me. Again, it's helpful if we know who you are. Just to say, the events are recorded and hopefully there'll be a podcast, subject to there being no technical difficulties. Hashtag, if you care about these things, is LSE events on the screen. And let's get on with it. So Ed Glaser is the Fred and Eleanor Glimp Professor of Economics at Harvard University, where he has taught economic theory and urban economics since 1992. Sorry, Ed. He has written hundreds of papers on cities, infrastructure and other topics, and books like Triumph of the City and Survival of the City. Ed, let's get on.
Let's get on with it. Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. I am thrilled and honored to be here, and I'm thrilled and honored that all of you have chosen to give me an hour and 15 minutes of your time for us to talk about cities today. I do want to just note first, there is a connection of this with Ronald Coase, and I just want, for those of you who haven't gone back and reread Coase, I realized as I was thinking about this that that was also like deeply meaningful for me, as I have written a series of papers in law and economics over the last 25 years with titles like Legal Origins and Securing Property Rights, all of which should be best seen as an extended footnote to Coase 61, right, in which we think about when the world is more Coasean and when the world is less Coasean. In fact, I've even written a paper called Coase versus the Coaseans, which attempts to sort of differentiate the sort of Coasean perspective, which is like everything works well with courts and it all is perfectly efficient, with the actual views of Ronald Coase, which was not that at all. Okay, with that, let's get started. I was told when I was asked to do this by Tim Besley that I was supposed to talk about housing supply, that that was what I was here to do, and so you will get stuff on housing supply. I think this is, in some sense, one of the great issues of our day. All right? Housing supply is why it is so expensive to be in London. It's why, you know, it is so difficult for young people to find their future in London. It is why so many of our urban spaces are strangled rather than growing, less productive, less welcoming than they possibly should be. I'm going to try and give you material from two recent papers, some of which may have a little bit of algebra, but you really don't need that. I will try to get the ideas across. A little bit of old work, and then we're going to end on a little bit on why this really matters and why there are larger social costs for screwing up housing. Much of this is going to be U.S.-centered, okay, because my work is typically U.S.-centered, and the U.S. has certain advantages for empirical work, which is it isn't dominated by one amazing, huge city, and there are lots of cities in it. But I've been told by Henry, and he will tell me when I'm screwing up, that it all applies to the U.K. as well, so I don't need to worry about this. Okay, so let me get started. So this is housing prices in six, let's say, famous and salient housing markets in the U.S. over the last 45 years. And you can see the two coastal markets, New York City and Los Angeles, which are still on top. You can see that they really have three convulsions. So you first saw these places booming in the 80s boom, and then you see them, you know, experiencing the mega boom of the great housing convulsion of the aughts, and then you see their recent run-up. And when I started working on housing supply about a quarter century ago, my model of America was there were coastal markets that were largely constrained, that faced very inelastic supply, but the rest of America was relatively open. It was relatively easy to build. Now, that's been changing, And so the next line that you see further down missed the 1980s, but experienced the great convulsion of the aughts in like crazy, and that's Phoenix, right? Massive increase, massive decrease, and it's back up again. And then, of course, you can see Atlanta and Dallas, which missed both of those earlier ones, but now are indeed experiencing a larger gain. And in some sense, the picture here is one in which it used to be about New York or Massachusetts or California, and now it's also about Miami and Phoenix and Dallas. And in some sense, all of America's metropolitan frontier is closing. Okay, and these cities, which at one point in time were superstars at producing ordinary homes for ordinary people, they've ceased doing that. Now, I'm not going to say a lot about non-US data on this, but apparently we're not the only place in the world with high and rising housing prices. Okay, and this is just OECD data on this stuff. UK, the pink means it's high, and it's actually higher than the US has been over the past 10 years. Now, the background, of course, for the high prices in London are the demand for London. The fact that, you know, its per capita output here is 78% higher than the rest of the UK. And, of course, Dr. Johnson was right when he wrote 250 years ago that when a man is tired of London, he is tired of life, because there is all in London that life can afford. And that still remains true. Especially, I had forgotten how great your weather was in spring. And of course, that's why you see a massive gap between prices and incomes, right? And so the London, as a classic consumer city, has people from all over the world who want to live here, even if they're not working here, because the pleasures of London are so extreme. And so it's this combination of economic dynamism, London as a consumer city, and also, you know, you're also an imperial city. You're also the capital of the country, all of which contributes to robust demand for living and housing, which, when it collides with restricted supply, produces extraordinarily high prices. Now, it is easy to forget now about just how much housing America once produced. And we built between 1950 and 1980, we delivered about 50 million new housing units in the United States, which is a staggering number. Okay, and through the 80s, we were still doing really a fairly impressive amount of growth. After the 2000s, it slowed down much more. And one way to see this is if America built at the same rate between 2000 and 2020 that it did between 1980 and 2000, America would have 15 million more homes, right? And so this is the sort of slowing down of construction. This is another way of seeing this. So this is just quantity of permits. This is single family over here. This is five or more units, and this is the 2 to 4 category. And you can see we really did have a last burst right before the 2006 period, especially in the Sunbelt cities like Phoenix, like Las Vegas. But since the global financial crisis, we have never recovered from that. And it is down everywhere. Now, the first paper I'm going to talk about is a Brookings paper that's joint with my long-term co-author on this, Joe Jerko. And here we're going to start with a couple of facts about what's changed in the US. And this is just the 50 largest metropolitan areas in the United States. And we're looking at the growth in housing units between 1980 and 2000, and the growth in housing units between 2000 and 2020. And what you can see is there are a whole number of sunny places, Orlando, Phoenix, Atlanta, Austin, Raleigh, Las Vegas is over there, right, which built enormous amounts. That line there is the 45-degree line. So the distance between the dot and the 45-degree line is how much less they produced over the last 20 years than they did between 1980 and 2000. And you can see just the enormous decline. Now, there are some places which were much lower, which kind of stayed on the line, but you really went from areas that were delivering astounding amounts of housing to places that really are not. This is the same graph for prices, okay? And here, you know, change in real median price over 80 to 2000, change in real median price 2000 to 2020. It shouldn't surprise you. These places that are way below in terms of quantities being delivered are way above in terms of prices going up, okay? And again, you see many of these Sunbelt places, Miami, San Diego, that are way up there in terms of price growth. And if you just take the places that had the top half of quantity growth between 1980 and 2000 and look at what's happened to the relationship between the change in housing units and the change in prices over the next 20 years, you can see the places that shrunk their production most are the places that also saw the highest level of price increases. Okay? Again, there's no repealing the laws of supply and demand. And that's sort of a steady theme of this, that like there's a lot of magical thinking which can occur in housing, which is, you know, maybe if we just do something, it'll change. And it's really about production, and it's really about, you know, using the core things of Economics 101. If you see prices going way up and quantity going way down, what kind of problem is it? It's a supply problem, okay? As opposed to prices up, quantity up, in which case you think it's about demand. This takes six areas, four of which are former Sunbelt superstars. And we're going to go deep in these six areas, and we're going to try and understand what's happened in them. Is it, for example, just that they've reached the point in which they've gotten as dense as other places are, and so is there just a density thing? Or is there something else that's going on? So these are Phoenix, Dallas, Miami, and Atlanta. And they're all chosen because they're former growth superstars. We've thrown in LA, a coastal city, and Detroit, Rust Belt, declining city for good measure, okay, just to have two comparisons in it. And you can see that, you know, three of them, Miami, Phoenix, and Los Angeles, all experienced a big boom during the 2006 period, but almost all of them have had a big run-up during this period. This is what has happened to production of housing units over the last 70 years in these areas. So in the variance has shrunk, and the quantities, the levels have shrunken enormously as well. So Phoenix is adding 15% per year in the 1950s, an astounding number. 6%, they're still at 5.58% in the 80s. And of course, all of these things have declined, right? It's all closing. Now, we're going to try and look at things at the neighborhood level, because you really do need to do that if you're going to ask yourself, are we just density leveling out? And that required, to do this paper required us to write a whole different paper on how you measure neighborhood change in America. Because the prevailing data set for looking at measure neighborhood change is something called the Longitudinal Tract Database, which involves these neighborhoods, tracts, and they match the tracts over time. But here's the problem with the LTDB. The tract definitions are based on 2010 tract definitions. And tracts are defined, so they have relatively equal population. Now, if I'm going to equalize you on the population ex post, okay, then a coefficient which you regress the change in population on the initial population will force that coefficient to be -1, regardless of what the underlying relationship is. Let me give you an easy example. Start with three areas. All of them are identical. All of them have a population of 100. Okay, of these three areas, one adds nothing, one adds 100, and one adds 200. Okay, so you have, at the end of the day, you have three areas, one with 100, one with 200, one with 300. But you're going to define the areas ex post. So you're going to put the two smaller ones together, creating one 300-person area, and you're going to have the other one having one 300-person area. Okay, by force, right, the one that had 300, the one that started with more, had less growth because you're equalizing ex post. And so you need to do, we don't have anything brilliant econometric to fix this. We just redid the whole data set using 1970 and 1980 boundaries. And so we just forced it. There surely must be econometric ways to do it that are clever. But to show you that this matters, if you regress change in population on initial population using the 2010 boundaries, this is the coefficients you get, a strong negative coefficient that looks like you get lots of mean reversion. This is what you get if you take 1970 boundaries. Not only is there not mean reversion, we're actually building more where there are more people initially. Okay? And so it's completely misleading to use the 2010 boundaries. Now, there are some things for which the 2010 boundaries are fine. If you're just measuring segregation over time, that's totally okay, where you're not trying to match the areas. But anything matched, this is a problem. And so please, if you're interested in doing this, we're happy to give you our data set. We're happy for people to use it as much as possible. It turns out if you use housing unit density added, it's not quite as stark, but it's the same thing, because housing units are pretty close to being the number of people. And so if you use the 2010 boundaries, it looks like there's massive mean reversion. If you take the 1970 boundaries, it looks like there's very little in terms of this stuff. Okay, what we do to figure out what's happening is we sort these neighborhoods on the basis of price and initial density levels. And so think about there being high price, high density, low density. Four areas. What you see in the early period, and I want you to focus on Atlanta, focus on this number, these numbers here, is that Atlanta is building in the 70s, 80s, and 90s in areas that are both high price and low density. And that shouldn't surprise you. High price means the returns to building are high, right? And low density, is it easier to build where there are existing homes or easier where there are no homes? Should be where there are no homes, right? So you kind of expect to see it. But it's kind of astounding how much they're doing. 90% of their building is in low density, low price areas, which means they're doing, you know, 210,000 units a year, 2010 units over the decade on this stuff. Flash forward, 50 years. And you notice this high price, low density share is just going down and down and down, right? And what's happening is they're building much less. So it goes from 330,000 to 164,000 in the aughts. And they're particularly building much less in high price, low density areas. And the story, when you look at it, and you want to, like, if you want the names of U.S. areas, they're places with names like Buckhead and Scottsdale, okay? They're kind of fancy places in the suburbs of Atlanta and Phoenix. And what's happened is these places have grown, okay? They're still low density, they're still high price, but they've added a lot of educated people who have come from places like California or New York. And the one thing we found out is that educated people are really good at doing when they move to an area is shutting down housing supply. Okay, because they're really good at taking over town meetings and figuring out how to make sure nobody's building anything that might block their view. And so as educated people have moved into these areas, they've managed to reproduce California right there in Arizona, which means no new building. The story is different in different areas. Okay, so Miami also has had, I mean, the reduction is enormous, 600,000 units in the 1970s to 180,000 units in the last decade. There, again, a reduction in low density, high price that's quite significant. But more of an increase in the high density, high price. And so the building that's going on in Miami is along the waterfront. Look at tall buildings. That's that model. Phoenix, reductions from 380,000 in the aughts to 188,000. That's more of a parallel reduction everywhere. Okay. Now, to try to give some rigor to this, I'm going to talk about things that I'm going to call empirical housing supply curves, which are basically just the relationship between housing being built and both density and initial price. Now, why do I call these empirical housing supply curves? Because I actually don't believe there's ever a possibility of estimating a true housing supply curve over any long frequency. Okay, and let me tell you why I believe it's an impossibility. This is one of the claims in this paper. Is that give me a variable that increases the attractiveness of a place and has that going over time. So let's say more jobs for skilled people in the area or nicer amenities in the area. Like that's a classic demand side thing, right? And so in the short run, that's a valid instrument for pulling in people and pushing up prices. But what happens over 5 years? What happens over 10 years when you have something nice? What kind of people moves in? Educated people, right? People with skills. And what do they know how to do? Shut down housing. And so because the demand side instrument changes the supply conditions over any longer time periods, it is impossible for me to imagine that you actually have a serious source of exogenous variation that only gets at demand and rather than influencing supply. And so what I want you to think about, and we're going to do the relationship between housing unit growth and price first, is there are two reasons why housing unit and growth might be related to price. One of which is you're getting variation in demand, okay? In which case, that should push you to have a nice positive relationship, right? If demand is different across areas, you should expect to see this positive. The second thing is something I'm calling here zoning costs, but how difficult it is to build, okay? And if you have variation in that, you should expect to see the places that are more restricted, you should expect to see these places having less construction and also higher prices, okay? And what the prediction is, the more important the heterogeneity in how difficult it is to build is, the more you should expect to see a negative relationship between price and building, or at least a flat one. And let me show you what you see. So in the 1970s, our estimated coefficients, they're all positive, and they're all sort of between 0 and 0.05, something like this. And then we calculate these coefficients in each subsequent decade. And what you can see is, in all of these cases, it's flattening out. They're still kind of positive, but they're all below the 45-degree line, which means they're all being pulled to zero, which tells you that instead of being driven by heterogeneity in demand, it's driven by heterogeneity in supply conditions. Right? It's moving that downward. Similar thing with initial density. The more that the relationship between density and building is driven by the straight cost effects of density, you should expect to see less building where there's more density. The more that it's driven by unobserved elements in how difficult it is to build, that should push things to be positive. Why? Because if it's easier to build there, you're going to have more density there initially, and you're going to see more building there now. Okay, so when you do that, what do you see? It's 1970 coefficients, strong and negative, and then it gets more and more positive over time. All of these things move in this positive direction. In fact, now it's basically flat. And this mirrors work that I did 20 years ago, which looked across Boston areas, which was restricted a long time ago, where you essentially see a strong positive relationship between density and building. Okay, the places that had the least space were adding the most. And that's not compatible with a view in which we're just naturally building where it's cheap to build. It's compatible with a view that the places that are dense are places in which it's relatively easy to add density because of unobserved supply conditions. And that's exactly how I interpret this, is you start negative, and then you end up zero or even positive. Again, the heterogeneity in supply conditions, even in these coastal areas, is coming to dominate rather than the factors that would determine either the demand for housing or would determine how easy it is innately to build. Okay, one question that I had, and this is again a detour, is when you talk to people, whether in London or elsewhere, right, about building in areas where there's already building, you will hear, oh, that's already built out, we can't possibly add more there, right? So no matter how many houses there are, they say it's already built out. And so I decided to take a look at New York between 1880 and 1940 and try to figure out what happened in New York. Because, you know, a lot of New York had housing there in 1880. But nobody said, you know, Fifth Avenue, it's already built out in 1880, right? There are like six mansions on the street going up and down. That's really, it's got to stay there. And so to do that, we took the micro-founded census reports. We then matched them over time, right? And we used a bunch of things involving fuzzy matching that I don't really understand at all. And we use that to create these maps of how New York changed. And so this is the change in units. You'll notice, just as in the great work that's been done by Daniel and his co-authors on the making of modern metropolis on London, right, you see this core downtown area, the quantities are dropping because offices are replacing homes. But then you see areas up here, right, where, you know, you have massive increases in the amount of building. We can create a matrix that looks at transitions from very low to very high, very low to very high. And the places that do transition from very low to very high have very large increases in the share of the population that are foreign born, right? They're providing opportunity for people who are coming to New York as outsiders to live in those areas. And that's fundamentally what housing was able to do in 1890, 1900, 1910, in London as well as New York, that you were providing space that enabled people who were not already existing homeowners to move there. Okay, back to the US, and now we're going to move to a couple of other things. There's going to be a bit of old papers, and then we're going to get to the second paper. But you're done with the Sun Belt. You don't have to think about Miami anymore. We're done with this. Okay, so this is from a paper in the Journal of Economic Perspectives about 7 years, and it sort of makes the point that supply matters. Along the x-axis, is the amount of building between 2000 and 2013 as measured by permits. And so a number like 0.5, which you can see there for Las Vegas, 0.5 means the number of permits are 50% of the housing stock in 2000. Okay, so 50%. If they had 500,000 houses in 2000, they permitted another 250,000 units. Along the y-axis is the gap between how much it costs to buy a house and how much it costs to build a house. So we have estimates of the marginal physical cost of construction, and so that gap is what's going on. And what you can see is the places that build a lot aren't expensive, and the places that are expensive don't build a lot. That is impossible to reconcile with a purely demand-driven view of the world, right? There is abundant demand for Austin, Texas, and there is abundant demand for San Francisco. In Austin, it shows up in terms of construction. In San Francisco, it shows up in terms of price, right? And it's, you know. Now, there also are low-demand areas, like with names like Detroit and Rochester and Toledo, so it's not like demand is totally irrelevant. But in terms of the high prices, it lines up with supply. And it's basically just an Econ 101 graph, which says there are some places with elastic supply where increases in demand show up in terms of quantities, so like some mythical place like Texas, and some places with inelastic supply, another mythical place, call it Massachusetts, where the prices just go up, where the quantities don't change. Another sort of amazing fact on, I'm now pivoting to a little bit on this gap between how much it costs to buy a house and how much it costs to build a house from a paper of mine from 20 years ago on New York City. And one of the interesting things, which again is compatible with a view of uncontrolled, unregulated housing, is that New York City, at a moment that it was getting vastly more expensive, was building shorter and shorter buildings. Okay, so the share of units in tall buildings peaked in the 1970s and it's been going down since then. Okay, which is sort of, at least when we wrote the paper in 2025. Now, there are a number of different ways for asking whether or not this is actually something that's related to regulation and versus other things that could conceivably make housing supply difficult. What I've shown so far is incompatible with demand being everything, but you know, could be lots of things in principle. So there are a couple of different ways, right? One of which you can look across metropolitan areas, and Joe and others have used the Wharton Land Use Index to look at this. But the index isn't random, right? And so what if wealthier places engage in more regulation, as I've already argued that they did? You can look within metropolitan areas, and my work with it involved the Pioneer Institute survey of Greater Boston land use regulations. These regulations are also not random. And also, when you look at within metropolitan area work, like one house in one community is typically a substitute for a house in another community. And so you can look at quantity effects of regulation. You can't really get a price effect of regulation very well. Again, because a house in one part of London, let's say you're not going to regulate one part as much as the other, those two houses are still substitutes from one another. So you do not see the full impact of the regulation on prices by looking at just that local area. And then the last is using economics. And this is still my favorite piece of evidence on this, which is if you know how much it costs to build an extra unit, we have our core logic of economics 101, or maybe intermediate micro if you must, right? That price is supposed to be equal to what? Marginal cost. Okay, if I know what marginal cost is and I know what price is, and I also know that this is a competitive market, and believe me, like these industries are hyper-competitive, thousands and thousands of potential builders. If you have that gap, then there must be something there that is stopping the market from doing what the market can do. And in much of America, right, price did come pretty close to marginal cost for decades, as it did in Las Vegas prior to 2006, or Phoenix, Arizona, or Houston, Texas. Okay, so this is the across metropolitan areas. This is Joe's Wharton Land Use Index on prices, and that shows a nice positive slope. Again, it's, you know, it's a cross-metropolitan area regression. Take it for what you want. Together with Bryce Ward, this is my work on Greater Boston, and there we see things like larger minimum lot sizes are associated with less building over our time period. Again, not particularly surprising. How could a larger minimum lot size generate more housing? Right, it's completely unimaginable. But then the thing that I'm more proud of is the work that we did to try to figure out what the marginal cost of delivering a housing unit was in New York. Because the beauty of building in New York or London is you don't actually require incremental land add units. And so you don't require incremental site preparation. All you require is adding an extra story. Okay? And any place where the housing is determined by tall buildings, the marginal cost is just the cost of building up. And so we did a lot of work to try to get what the cost was of building up using different ways. But our estimates were, you know, by the 2000s, it was about twice as much to buy as it was to build. That, you know, these units in some places were costing thousands of dollars, and it was $300 or $400 a square foot to build up. And so that gap felt to me like the thing that I believed most about the role of regulation, because economics told it to me. And I think there's a really important lesson here for us that, like, don't think of yourself, if you're actually an economist and you're interested in data, don't think of yourself as, I'm just a statistician who's interested in causal inference, right? Causal inference is great. We love causal inference. But use the economics, right? There's a reason why price theory, microeconomics is powerful, and it's because you get things like this. You get tests that enable you to look for stuff that would not come out of just being a, you know, being a statistician who looked for a relationship between X and Y that might or might not be causal. Now, outside New York, it's harder because you've got to deal with land, okay? And the best we can do on this is price land by asking how much is land worth when it extends an existing lot, versus how much is land worth when it sits under a new lot. The difference is when it extends an existing lot, meaning you have a 2-acre lot instead of a 1-acre lot, that extra acre doesn't necessarily come with the right to build. Okay, it just comes with a, you know, you got acreage you can look at. You can presumably stop somebody else from building on it. Whereas if you've got an acre under an existing thing, then it came with the right to have that house. Our estimates were that when you looked at acres that extended versus acres that were under existing lots, the acres that extended were worth 1/10 of the acres that sat under a new lot. Or to put another way, when you took those values and you look at what the gap is between the price of how much it costs to buy and the price of how much it costs to build, using that the acreage that extends an existing lot for your price of land, they're about 50% of the cost of buying in San Francisco was from the zoning tax, was from the limitations on building. Okay, now all this work presupposes that construction technology is like an exogenous thing, okay? And I did this for, you know, we sort of took that as given. But what if the cost of building itself is endogenous to these rules? What if these rules, in kind of a long-term sense, end up making us worse at providing space, making us worse at building? And I'm quite struck by how bad America is at building things. So this is a graph of Turner & Townsend's dollar per square meter. And like San Francisco, New York, LA, and Chicago are all up here. Okay, London's down here. I mean, you're not great, but you're, and then of course you've got this cluster of Dubai and Riyadh and so forth. The US, in terms of building metro lines, The NYU transit cost database says we're four times the OECD average per kilometer of building a metro line, like covered or uncovered, however you want to do it. America spends on average $1.05 million for an electric bus. You can buy a perfectly nice 36-foot electric bus from Hyundai for $350,000. Okay, it's astounding what we do in our country. And I started looking. We tried to put together data on construction productivity over the long run. Now, this is a very simple. This is inspired partially by Austin Goolsbee and Chad Syverson's work on the strange, sad path of construction productivity overall. We're just focused on residential, and we're focused on a much longer time period than they are. So this is a very simple measure of productivity, which is homes per worker. Okay, and what you see in this is from 1900 to 1940, homes per worker are pretty flat. Then 40 to 70, it goes way up. Then 70 onward, it goes way down. So it's not as if construction productivity has always got to go backward. And I mean, the Goolsbee-Syverson story is one of Baumol's cost disease, that in a world in which like there's no technological change, if the price of labor is going up because of other industries where there is technological change, your industry is going to look less productive over time. So think about his classic example being barbers. Technology hadn't changed, but in some sense, the seeming efficiency of this has gone way down. Okay. Now, one way to think about this is to compare housing with another big thing that we purchased, which is cars. Okay. And I like this comparison because one of the complaints you get about this is, well, our houses are different. Our houses are better. Our houses are more complicated. But you know what's really different? Our cars are totally different than what they were in 1970. Okay. And yet, this is housing units per employee, and this is cars per employee. So cars per employee relative to 1970 is up by more than 50%. Housing per employee is way down. Okay, so it's going in exactly the wrong direction. We also get to look at this in terms of just the cost of producing a constant economic quality home, and this comes from RS Means data. And you can see there that's rising in real dollars as well, and rising quite substantially from, let's say, its peak around the 2000s, it's up by more than 30%. Okay, we have a model. I don't think any of you really want algebra right now, so let me give it to you in words, okay? The elements of the model are this. There are developers out there. The developers get to propose projects. The projects may or may not be accepted by the community. When the community gets tougher, when regulation gets tougher, then the cost of proposing a big project goes up, meaning you're less likely to get it through. And so the developers, they propose smaller and smaller projects. Okay, but they can't just compensate by having a gazillion small projects because we've assumed a span of control cost, which says that you know you get worse at doing projects, you've got to run around and monitor a gazillion projects. And so as the zoning gets tougher, the projects get smaller, the companies get smaller, and technology gets worse. Because what technology is in this model is it's a fixed investment that firms make at getting smart about their production process. And if they're doing less and less, they've got less and less to spread that technology over. Okay, and that's basically the logic of this model, is that sort of small projects mean small firms. Small firms mean we don't invest in things like knowledge that get to be spread across lots of different things. I want to highlight here the difference between project and regulation and what we normally think of as entry regulation. So normally, when you think about George Stigler's regulation, you think about regulation that like firms pay once, that becomes a fixed cost, that's a barrier to entry, that leads to incumbent firms that are protected against competition in different ways. This is very different than project-level regulation. We have both in our model. But whereas entry regulation leads to big dominant firms that will invest in cost-cutting technology, will have a problem for monopoly profits, of course, project regulation ends up in tiny firms who do tiny projects and don't invest in things. You're not getting that. You're not getting that. Okay, so the first fact that goes along with this is the size distribution of establishments that are involved in new single-family housing versus everything else. So in all the other sectors that we have down here, the median employee works in an establishment with more than 500 employees, right? There are these things called scale economies that kind of work, and you're dominated by big things. The median employee in new single-family housing works in an establishment with between 5 and 9 fellow workers. And you know what a firm of 7 workers doesn't have? It doesn't have a research and development department. Okay, and you have these, which is exactly what the model is doing, right? You have these tiny, tiny firms. And they've shrunk it a little bit over time. The change isn't huge over the time period that we have it, but you know, this is the general building contractor, which is probably the closest thing to this. So it's the fraction with more than 50 employees has dropped from about 65% down to 50%. But this is not exactly comparable with this. This comes from microdata in the census where we can actually merge exactly what they're doing. This is sort of a larger thing. So What we decided to do was to figure out, was our story right? Did we see changes in project size over time? And the person that we have in mind is William Levitt. So William Levitt was a master builder in the United States after World War II who figured out how to do mass production in suburban America. So he built these Levitt towns. They're these little things, and you'd have them, you'd lay down a road, and you'd go have the carpenters go up and down, and you'd have the plumbers go up and down, and you sort of got things like scale economies into building. And so we're trying to figure out if these still exist. And so what we've got to do is we use the CoreLogic data, which has, you know, 51% of the US population, 167 counties, and we have an algorithm for trying to figure out large-scale projects. Start with a home, okay, built during a two-year period, run a loop, 100 yards around it. If you find another home built in the same year, that's part of a project, and just keep on looping, okay? And then for the large ones, you then go in and check whether or not this actually was a project, and they typically were. For the small ones, you know, it is what it is. And you'll have some false positives and false negatives. So Lakewood, for example, you can see that here. In the early 50s, Lakewood is this thing which is building 3,500 units in the early 1950s. This is the top 1% of the top 1%. So this is really the mega projects. But you really see in LA, there were these mega projects in the 1950s, and they aren't there anymore. And they sort of diminished over time. For the US as a whole, there's also this general pattern. But there's this tantalizing moment of the aughts where you see some really big projects going on outside of Phoenix, outside of Las Vegas. And of course, that's completely disappeared since the global financial crisis. And we've got the end of large-scale projects over time. We also know that large firms are much more productive. They're much more capital intensive. Okay, unsurprisingly, that's true in every industry known to humanity. This is what it looks like in terms of output or revenue per employee across size bins. Like, about four times more productive in those firms that are more than 500 plus employees in residential housing. Okay, so it's a massive increase in productivity associated with scale, but that scale is not usable if every project is two houses that you have to squeeze into some suburban lot. And we can engage in some counterfactuals. If you believe that some fraction of this cross-sectional relationship is causal, you know, let's say you thought that half of it were, you'd get 60% increase in productivity by moving to the size distribution that you see in manufacturing from the current size distribution. And of course, regulation predicts all of this stuff. So regulation predicts smaller firms, regulation predicts less productivity, regulation predicts less output. Okay, last fact on this paper, and now I have to segue to the last thing, which is telling you why I think this is a problem. So patent levels by industry. The red line is construction, the green line is manufacturing, the gray lines are everything else. And with these three series are normalized so that 1930, they all have the same dot. So it's normalized so that it's the same amount. You can see it's sort of amazing how much they track each other for the first 100 years of the series. You see a slight widening in the 50s and 60s, and then after 1970, it's night and day, right? Manufacturing is exploding, construction is like blah. Okay, and it's not as if the patents are going on the upstream firms that cater them. We've checked that as well, right? There's just a totally different level of innovation and productivity, but it doesn't need to be that way. And our view on the Baumol's cost disease thing is, yes, every industry that doesn't innovate face Baumol's cost disease, but there's no natural reason why construction can't innovate. It did innovate like crazy between 1950 and 1970, but we stopped it because we regulated the projects.
I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Okay, last bit. The cost of overregulating building. And we can talk about whether or not this is true in the UK as well. So highly productive places have become unaffordable. I can't think of a better poster child for highly productive places that become unaffordable than London, right? You know, it's more extreme, the productivity difference between London and the rest of the UK than it is anywhere in the US and the rest of it, and the price differences are also similarly stunning. Two. Whole countries become less productive because people can't move to cities where firms are more productive. This is assuredly, it's a non-trivial deal in the US. Our estimates are, you know, you moved around a bunch of the growth, you could get maybe 8 or 9% more GDP if you move people to more productive areas in a plausible way. I bet you could get significantly more of that in the UK because the productivity gap is much larger. People remain trapped in regions of economic dysfunction because more productive places are too expensive. I'll show you a graph of that for a second. Opportunity for the children of the poor is reduced. Poor families live in isolated neighborhoods, offset on the far edge of urban areas. Insiders become wealthier, outsiders lose out. Housing bubbles become more extreme. Building becomes less efficient, I've already shown you that. And we harm the environment. In the US, that means pushing out and away from temperate areas. So it means building in Houston instead of building in California, as well as building on the urban edge instead of in the urban core. In the UK, it really just means building on the urban edge instead of building on the urban core. Okay, so let me just show you a little bit about this. This is Ganong and Shoag. So these were two former students of ours. This paper was published in the Journal of Urban Economics. They show you that there's a strong correlation between 1940 and 1960 between higher income states and population growth. Okay, the states that are more productive, that have higher incomes, are growing more quickly. Between 1990 and 2010, that relationship is, if anything, reversed. And you have faster growth in areas that are actually less wealthy. And the downside of this, of not moving to productive places, which, you know, it's hard not to think that housing plays a major role in this, is that too many Americans remain trapped in economic dysfunction. So when I was born in 1967, roughly 5% of prime-aged males, prime-aged is between 25 and 54, and if you can do the math based on when I was born, you can figure out why I find that so offensive. But for most of the last 15 years, 15% of prime-aged males have been jobless. And just keep in mind, sort of like I know we're economists, we're materialists, but there's every evidence that we have that being jobless for prime-age males is vastly worse than being poor, right? The sense of purpose, the sense of social connection, all of that comes with jobs, and you see it in terms of the opioid use, you see it in terms of deaths, you see it in terms of divorces, right? This is really a dysfunctional thing. One of the reasons why, right, you see this, and like, just look at the geography. There's a bunch in here, this is a very low density area, along here as well. And then there's sort of a very large sector here, which is America's dysfunctional eastern heartland, which is the epicenter of American economic distress. And it starts down in Mississippi and Louisiana, it goes up through Appalachian, and it ends in the Rust Belt. In some of these areas, 25% of prime-age males are jobless. Okay, and so this is really concentrated pain. Why do I think housing has something to do with this? Well, they're jobless, right? Someone else is providing them with homes. 35% of them, even the ones in their 40s, are living on their parents' couches or in their old bedrooms. And you know, their parents may have a home in eastern Kentucky. They don't, unfortunately, have a studio apartment for them in San Jose, California, for them to work in. And so the housing helps to keep them in place. And assuredly, this is also an issue in the UK as well. Okay, this is Raj Chetty's data on upward mobility. Right, this is where a 25th percentile kid, so his parents were poorer than 3/4 of America, richer than 1/4, ends up as an adult. We sort the metropolitan areas based on this. 1 means the least upward mobility, 5 means the most, and then we just calculate the average Wharton residential land use in those areas. What do you see? You see that the areas that are good for people are massively more regulated than the areas that are bad for kids. Okay. So what's happening is that these areas are doing a marvelous job of making sure that no parents with poor children can actually find their future there. In some sense, I think of this in the framework that Manker Olson gave us with the rise and decline of nations. So Olson was writing 40 years ago and was writing with a vision in which stable societies accrue insiders who get power over time, and they figure out how to do rules so that outsiders suffer and don't get to take their stuff away from them. He was very inspired by England in the 1970s, and maybe, you know, when I read this in the early 1990s, I thought, you know, insider capture, maybe that's the New York of my youth, maybe that's coastal California, but it doesn't sound like that's much of America to me. It seems like we're still a nation for outsiders. 40 years later, I think he's completely right, and housing policy is, you know, ground zero for this, that insiders have taken out and outsiders have have paid the price of it. You can't see these numbers. Okay, this is another way you see this, is the massive intergenerational transfer of wealth. And all of you who are under the age of 30 should be worried about this, or should be unhappy about this in some way. Although I actually want you to leave here with joy rather than pain. But I have to make you angry before we'll lift you up. Okay, so in 1983, the 50th percentile 35 to 44-year-old had $56,000 of housing wealth. The 75th percentile had $118,000. Flash forward 30 years, the median 35 to 44-year-old has $6,000 of housing wealth. So that's a 90% lower number. The 75th percentile is down to $58,000. Where has all that housing wealth gone? Well, let's look at the 99th percentile, 65 to 74-year-old. They've gone from $900,000 to $2 million, okay? And so a massive intergenerational transfer, which if you bought in California in 1975, right, you have made an extraordinary amount of money, as you did in London if you bought in the right time as well on your purchase. But of course, someone who comes in without that housing wealth doesn't benefit. Housing bubbles are more extreme. This is from a paper from 2009, I think, with Joe and Albert Saez. This is Atlanta, we think still relatively uncontrolled back then, relatively elastic. The green shows quantity. The orange shows price. Great housing boom of the aughts. Quantity's going crazy. Price is flat, right? You just want to think elastic housing supply, demand shooting up and down. The prices don't move, but the quantity moves. By contrast, this is San Francisco. What's happening to quantity? It's still green. Quantity's not doing anything, right? And price is going up and price is going down. Okay, so it's all about, you know, the ability to build, getting rid of the rough edges of the sort of great housing convulsions. This is a more general statistical fact that, you know, the more that we make housing like Rembrandt's, where they're not making them anymore, right, the more that you can expect to see large asset bubbles around this. The more that housing is like buying a Toyota or a toaster, right, the less likely you are to have these kind of extreme bubbles because, you know, they'll just make more of them. You don't get asset bubbles in toasters because they'll just make more toasters. Okay, last point on the environment. Together with Matt Kahn, in a paper called The Greenness of Cities, we estimated carbon emissions for a standardized household living in different parts of America. By far, across metropolitan areas, by far the greenest natural parts of America are coastal California. Why? Well, carbon emissions are explained by two things across America, right? They're explained by January temperature, and they're explained by July temperature. July temperature determines electricity. January temperature determines fuel use, okay? And California has really mild winters and really mild summers, right? And those things just explain this, which means that if you were a California environmentalist who wanted to reduce America's carbon footprint, you would be out there screaming, why aren't you building more housing right here, right near San Francisco Bay? And of course, that's not what you saw at all historically. Now maybe a little bit of it. But instead, we have a massive amount of environmental stuff that says no to housing in California. And of course, when you say no to housing in California, it's not like you're saying no to housing, period. You're turning off the local faucet, and it's going on outside of Houston. It's going on outside of Oklahoma City. It's going on in some other place where it's much rougher. There's also, of course, a gap between central city and outside, mostly associated with larger living spaces, which have more energy outside central cities, and driving longer distances. If we make it hard to build in the pricier areas that are close to the city center, and we push housing to the outside, we are also making it worse on the environment. What actually can change this? And now I'm getting ready to stop, Henry, so I don't think you need to do this. But we know a couple of things. We know typically bigger places like to build more. So the fact that control, even within London, is at a very local level, like the power of the boroughs, the power of the local areas, that's going to make things very hard. Because the more that a community has lots of different actors, like employers who actually want to hire workers that aren't going to be more expensive because of what they pay, builders who want to build, bankers who want to lend, right? You have different voices. If you shrink to the level seen in a bedroom borough or bedroom suburb in the US, where you only have homeowners, right, there's no way they're going to want to build anything. Because you know what? Affordability isn't their problem. You know what affordability means? Their largest asset is worth more. Right? And the last thing they want to do is to make it easy to build in a way that reduces the housing prices in that area. On top of it, the building is going to be inconvenient, and maybe it's going to be more crowded on the streets. And so that's the general, the problem with the smaller jurisdictions. Clément shows when small areas in France get merged into bigger areas, you get more building. And I want to end on just a couple of comments about, you know, how do you end this? In some sense, it all comes back to COES, as in some sense it all does, right? Which is, it's the current, like, homeowners stand to lose, other people stand to win. Almost assuredly, there should be some COESian bargain there where the winners compensate the losers, right? We have totally failed to make that happen. And we, you know, every estimate that I've ever seen for the size of the zoning tax relative to maximizing total property value is it's way, way too large. We've made it way too difficult relative to sort of how much value you could get by building more housing. Right? And yet, like, the world isn't cozy enough. And I think there's basically no chance of persuading homogeneous bedroom suburbs to voluntarily change their permitting processes. Bigger places are more open to building. So in the US, you know, I can talk to mayors, we can do things in which that has success. In the US, the big battle is in state houses. And the weird thing about the US is that the federal government has no direct way to actually influence localities, because everything the federal government does has to go through the states. And so all you can do is create bribes. And there is a bill that I've been involved in the last year called the Build Now Act, which tries to create weak financial incentives to try to get smaller areas to build. But the beauty of the UK is you don't have our federal system, which means that, like, your federal government can change land use regulations on a dime if it has the courage to do so, right? And in some sense, that's my final message on this, is that you can make change in the UK. And in some sense, like, the fight against NIMBYism, right, the fight for change, the fight for growth, the growth that will benefit everyone here who is under the age of 30, right, is a fight for hope against fear. And I think there's an enormous amount to hope for in the future of the UK, in the future of London, in the future of our species. But it requires us to be able to change our world, and it requires our future not to be a prisoner to the past. And that requires having the courage to be willing to do things which are not universally popular, right? And that means allowing there to be the freedom to actually deliver the homes that will make England, Britain, a more equitable place, a place of more opportunity, a more productive place, a more environmentally comfortable place, and a place with more hope. Thank you.
Thank you. Perfectly timed. So we've got about 25 minutes for questions. I'll start here in the room. There should be some roving mics. Hands up, and I will.
Can we call on people if they don't raise their hands, Henry? Is that allowed?
We can do that. We'll do that in a bit. There's a person here with the green top. Then maybe you could slowly get a mic over to the person there.
Hi, I'm Manan Sumit Agrawal. I'm a second year undergraduate here at LSE. I'm studying accounting and finance. Thank you so much for coming. It was wonderful to listen to your talk. I wanted to know, like, going forward, what do you think the supply will look like for luxury hospitalities or fine dining hotels here in London, if you had any view on that?
On luxury hospitality? Anyway, that's a question for you. Tell me the question,
because you remember how deaf I am.
That's right. So he wanted to know the future of the supply of luxury hospitality here in London.
Luxury hospitality or luxury housing?
Hospitality.
Hospitality.
No idea. I mean,
it's going to be great. It's going to be great. Next question. No, okay.
But Ed, to reflect on this a little bit, because yes. I think the direction here is there is a tendency to be very critical of what is going on at the upper end of the housing market for the problems that the big mega cities see. So you get this in New York, you get this in London. I mean, what does the evidence say on the extent to which it's really, you know, this upper end, the foreign buyers, you know, the sheikhs or the Russians as when they could buy housing, versus really the bog standard stuff that's going on in terms of, you know, the bulk of the housing market?
So I think we need to wait for Professor Sturm to tell us about what he's learned about empty units in London for later, and hopefully he will elucidate that. Most of places in the U.S., the foreign buyers aren't a huge share of the market as a whole. They may be a huge share of a tiny niche element in that market. It is also true that in terms of building overall units, as you make things more difficult to build overall, you tend to move things into the luxury bracket. And that's somewhat unfortunate in that, you know, if what everyone sees with new building is a pencil-thin 60-story thing in which only billionaires have units in this, that's really not, like, making the case for the upside of housing supply very well. Now, I'm not against allowing these things, but I'm sure as heck in favor of fast-tracking units that are more likely to serve ordinary people, right? And I'm sure as heck in favor of doing things that deliver more units rather than fewer units on this. And so I don't think I'm against allowing there to be fancy units being built, but the real hope is that we get plenty of units that are not fancy. Two more observations on this, though, which are, I think, important. One of which is the when housing works well, so think about housing units in sort of post-war cities. In New York, for example, the Upper East Side of Manhattan, there are units that I grew up in as a kid, with these glazed brick sort of mass market housing that was built for middle-income people after World War II. They weren't typically the poorest New Yorkers that were living there, but by housing middle-income New Yorkers, they were putting reduced pressure to gentrify other areas. And you shouldn't sort of think that all new housing for middle-income or upper middle-income people is bad, because the opposite of that is the gentrification that causes so much trouble everywhere else. Second point is, if you're really worried about there being some empty houses out there, I'm telling you, your property taxes aren't high enough, okay? Because someone who's actually living in your area paying for housing should ideally be paying for more than enough property taxes to cover any cost that they're paying for social services. And so their natural response is, if you think there's a problem, then jack up property taxes. Not just to be clear, not the stamp duties. I mean, sort of a flow tax on that's associated with property.
That's a helpful clarification at the end. Right, just a reminder to people online that you can use the Q&A function. But in the meantime, there was another question upstairs.
Hi there. Thanks for the talk. My name is Milo. My question is, do you see a role for market-based solutions to the housing supply problem?
Yeah, I think I only see a role for market-based solutions for the housing supply problem.
Think about innovation, and I wonder if you could elaborate on that.
Sure. I think real affordability comes from having, you know, an ability to rent just a normal unit, not some special affordable unit, not some unit you've been lotteried into, at a reasonable price. I don't know how that doesn't happen without ordinary builders doing things and without a regular, fairly simple process for doing that. What I think sensible, like, land use regulations look like are as-of-right plans, which say that, you know, you get relatively light review as long as you fit within some box of having to do things. And the light review is done in a matter of months, not in a matter of years. And we don't allow everyone who's within a mile to have a veto power over every project. And the hope is that if you create it, you make it easy enough to build enough housing, right, that people will start investing in new technologies again. I mean, there's a video of mine on the My Cities X, and let me plug my online video course, which is all free. It's on YouTube. It's Cities X, and you can look at videos. I do a bunch of videos with Mark Vlesing of Pocket Living showing, like, these mass-produced, these prefabricated high-rises that he puts into London, right, where you take in the slab, one floor goes in, another floor goes in, another floor goes in. And part of the beauty of that is the neighbor's mindless, because it's not a two-year building process. It's a month-long building process. And so, like, technological innovation is easy to happen if it becomes easy enough to build. And so the regulation will allow this to work. And exactly what form it'll take, I don't know, but, you know, that's the beauty of technological innovation, is you don't know what's coming.
Right, that's six. Let's have here the blue jumper here. Just before we go to the question there, what about the role of the state, though, in building? I mean, that's a very live debate here about whether a big part of the issue is the fact that there's been such a collapse in the social housing supply.
Look, I'm not going to speak about your state. I know that our state, when it built its own housing, was pretty awful at it. And I would not want to reproduce the horrors of the U.S. public housing projects of the 50s, 60s, and 70s, which also, by the way, created massive concentrations of poverty, which were sort of fairly terrible for the poor kids that lived in them. So, you know, whether or not, what exactly you want in terms of, like, a housing voucher strategy, I think that's entirely reasonable, especially if the vouchers are targeted with parents and young children, and they have things in place to try to get those parents with young children into neighborhoods that are good for kids. I think we should be totally open to an aggressive housing policy of that nature. But certainly the U.S., I would not trust our government to build anything, and our government to build anything in the housing space. Singapore can do it. But just because Singapore can do something doesn't mean that, like, your government can.
Right, great. Sorry, there we go.
Thanks, Ed. It's a really great speech. And my name is Mong, and I'm working on remote work myself. Mm-hmm. So we all see this surge of remote work during the COVID. And post-COVID, the remote work is stabilized around, like, 20%. 20% of work is done at home. Do you think this trend of remote work can somehow theoretically ease up the negative effects on the economy, employment, and maybe the environment? And right. Do you see that in the data?
Remote work.
So the U.S. number is about, the U.S. number that uses address-based interviewing as opposed to online-based interviewing. So online interviewing, we think almost assuredly, gives you numbers that are too high for remote work. U.S. number is about 10% fully remote and about 10% part-time remote. So, like, 15% on a given day are likely to be remote. I don't have any problem with going remote. I don't think it's a solution to these problems. I don't think it's nearly enough. And the problem is that people want to be in London, as we started with, even if they're not even working. If even they're working remotely in Dubai, they may still want to be living in London. So it's a general issue. I will just make a comment for younger people on remote work, though, because, like, you did not get the sort of face-to-face interactions, and the cities that enable those interactions are magical things, part of my talk. But that is also something that I believe very strongly. And I'll just give you a fact, which is both in Nick Bloom's original work on remote work in China, it's also in a more recent prize-winning paper, and I think AEJ something, by Natalia Manuel and Emma Harrington, who are our students. Both papers find the same thing for workers that go remote, which is, like, they're just as productive if you're remote. These are call center workers, so they're taking calls. You can make just as many calls if you're remote. But both papers also find that your probability of being promoted drops by more than 50%, okay? And if you think about it, what are you learning when you're remote, right? And to be promoted, like, you actually have to be someone that the boss trusts to handle difficult calls. How would you learn to handle difficult calls if you were remote? How would your boss learn that you were good at handling difficult calls if you were remote? In some sense, this learning channel, especially learning about stuff that you don't know you need to know, gets shut down when we're not in the same room with one another. I'm doing this extended rant because there are a lot of people who are under the age of 30 here. And I think the point of your 20s is to hang around smart people and to figure out how to be smarter and to do whatever it is that you think your vocation is, whether or not it's, and I really hope it is trying to make the cities of the developing world more livable. So that's my hope that that's your vocation. But whatever it is, like, you will be better at doing your vocation if you actually surround yourself by talented people that you can learn from. And the reason that I believe that is not, like, any regression, although there are regressions that show things like this, but it's my own experience as a 22-year-old sitting behind Gary Becker in like Chicago seminars and learning how to be an economist from hanging around amazing people and learning things I had no idea that I actually needed to know. And I think the more that we have on AI, I think the more valuable this kind of task stuff is going to be, not the less.
Great. I think there are several more. So the flowery shirt here, and then maybe you could get the mic over to the person in the jumper there. Let's go flowery shirt. Sorry, flowery shirt first.
It's flourish. Hey, I'm Akash. I'm a PhD student in the department. You talked about the like super rich and wealthy and educated individuals moving into neighborhoods and making it harder for people to join either through zoning regulations or imposing pressure on politicians. I'm curious, when you present this evidence on the cost of local regulation to state governments, what their reaction is, and why it's been so consistently difficult to get any change, and how much of that relates to the political economy of how zoning regulations are done and interest groups that might be involved.
So it's interesting. So when I started working on this stuff in like 2001, like there was like one libertarian economist who thought I wasn't wasting my time, right? I remember getting a letter from Tom Sowell like in 2002 thing, saying I might be onto something with this thing. And that was all very exciting. And last year, maybe 2 years ago now, on the floor of the Democratic National Convention, Barack Obama was talking about land use regulations. And that was one level pretty amazing. And I sort of feel like I don't have there's not a big pushback that like the supply matters and supply is going in the wrong direction, that supply has gone in the right direction. But in some sense, the reason why Barack Obama is talking about it, the reason why it remains high, is I've made absolutely no policy impact whatsoever in the last 25 years. But it's not that I've made no policy impact, and like, it's not that I haven't persuaded people, it's that the politics are just very, very hard. This is not like changing the Bank of England's monetary policy, where you just need to change the other economists, right? This is a big political economy area where there are lots of people who are playing in this. And for every victory that you make in terms of persuading a governor that like you know what you're talking about, he's still got to face the state legislature and doing stuff. Now, California state legislature, as I said, is the place where it's on the front lines. There is a YIMBY movement, right, which is sort of amazing. Like, are they winning everything yet? No, but you see a dog playing chess, you don't ask how he'd do against Magnus Carlsen, right? I mean, it's sort of an amazing thing. And I think we're making progress, but it's slow because there are lots of incentives that run in the opposite direction. We'll see. I'm very grateful to Eric Ezra Klein and Derek Thompson for their Abundance book, which has popularized a whole bunch of this stuff. I'm a little bit worried that Abundance is a very democratic book. It's a very democratic thing, and this issue has Bill Nowak got out of committee 11-0. So 11 to like in our current fractious world, 11-0, this thing came out, which means that we could have a bipartisan thing on this, but and I'm just worried that it becomes a one-party thing, which is not what I want to happen at all. But thank you for your question.
Now hold on, just before I take another one from the room, I'm looking at you, Andrea. Have we had any questions online that have not magically reached me?
Yes. So one question from Maddie Edwards. There's often a tension between the need to accelerate housing supply and the realities of viability at a project level, particularly rising cost, planning constraint. From your perspective, what are the most effective policies to bridge that gap without compromising on quality or affordability? Like a policy question.
As of right zoning, you want a plan that says if you do this, you can get started tomorrow, right, or with some form of minimal review. The more that everything involves 6 years of community meetings to discuss exactly what you're doing, the more the community thinks they don't just get to limit the size of the thing, but they get to opine on window treatments, right? Opine on exactly what paint job goes on everything, the more this thing becomes impossible because you get 6 year, 8 year processes of talking people through. And if you have an 8 year process, there's no way you can move anything forward.
Back to the person who was patiently waiting here. You put hands up, I'll get the mics to you as well.
Hi, Paul Schultz. Thank you for giving the talk. I would just like to ask, is the question of supply that vital in the medium and long term, just because of the fact that the population growth rates are dipping below replacement rates, and therefore it will decrease the level of demand and might even result in price deflation?
If you take all of our countries, we're fine. If you're not worried about, like, if you're worried, like, can every Briton be housed? Yeah, every Briton can be housed, but they're not going to be housed in places that are very productive, and not going to be housed in places that they want to live. And that's certainly true in the U.S. as well. And the problem is housing is in place, right? And because it's not necessarily in the places that people want to live, even if the aggregate is going down, you still can have a tremendous mismatch between where demand is and where supply is at the local level. So that's sort of the fundamental reason why you don't get out of this at the macro, in some sort of macro level, just because of declining fertility rates.
Right, let's go up to the person green. Let's go up first, and okay. Then you're afterwards. So upstairs first.
Thank you for your talk. Do you think that there are any big similarities, or do you have any general regards or remarks from your studies in the U.S. market, like regarding the Hong Kong housing market, because it's also one of the most constrained housing markets in the world?
So Hong Kong is deeply interesting, right? I mean, it's also like all the land is publicly owned, right, as I recollect. They typically have made it fairly easy to add more density, so you can tear down things and put things up pretty easily, but the natural constraints of the island are pretty extreme. I think Hong Kong lets you figure out sort of how much is sort of innate from production technology in a relatively pro-building environment versus how much is just costs. And I think with Hong Kong, it's a sort of innate cost more than the regulation just driving things in terms of the city. But I've never myself worked on, I have worked on China. So I did have a paper maybe 7 or 8 years ago where we thought that the great housing collapse in China was completely predictable, because they were building an enormous amount of housing in places that were relatively low demand, and just the level of vacancies were enormous. And so we think this whole thing was completely obvious in 2017 or 2018. But I've never worked on Hong Kong per se.
All right, so we've got one down here. If we can get the mic over to the two here who look keen, and then there's one up there after. So downstairs first.
Okay, thank you for the lecture, Juan Pedro from LDT program. My question is, you showed a map of house affordability in the European Union at the beginning of your presentation, mm-hmm. and the Netherlands, Spain, and I think also France, I think it was in white, but is there something we could learn from those countries that they are doing good to have affordable housing?
I am sure, but I don't know what it is right now. Okay, I think in general, Spain is relatively good in terms of production, but I will say it is shocking, like, how much the housing world is focused on U.S. data, and to a, like, and then, like, there are a few heroes, like Henry and Paul, who also do UK stuff, but, like, Europe as a whole, there's way, way too little. And I will say this to all of you who are thinking about dissertations and have some interest in the real estate space, like, there's so much more that can be done in EU housing on this stuff. And it's like a giant intellectual arbitrage opportunity to take advantage of. So my hope is that you will take away from this and you'll write a great paper in 2 years, and I'll get to see you on the job market, having written a fantastic paper teaching me the lessons of France and Spain about what I should know about housing supply in those areas.
Right, let's hoover up three now, because we've got quite a lot. So we'll take one there, and then the question, I don't know whether it was two or one here, but one there and then here, and then you can pick.
I can dodge all three.
You can dodge all one.
Yeah, you can try dodging this. Hi there. My name's Ethan. I'm also in the local economic development program. I'm interested, coming from Bethesda, Maryland, which is probably very much like Boston in certain ways, Montgomery County. There's some tens of thousands of approved permitted housing that have not been built. And so I struggle sometimes to, something's missing from this picture where, in theory, this housing could be built. It is not being built, and the permitting isn't the issue. Or it doesn't appear to be the issue. I've talked to the lobbyists in the area about it, who like represent the developers and whatnot.
Okay, great. So let's take these delays in build out.
We talked about.
Could you say who you are, please?
Oh, sorry, I'm Oscar. Hi.
Hi, Oscar.
I'm a local student, and I was thinking, we've talked about Hong Kong and geographical constraints for London itself and the Green Belt Initiative. How would you like weigh this with ideas around your ideas around density and like environmental restrictions?
Right, and we'll take the one next to you as well.
I'm Ben, and I'm also a local student. I've studied a lot of Detroit's decline, and I think its population has fallen to 600,000. Would making Detroit recover help fill housing pressures elsewhere due to the massive amounts of vacant housing?
Great. Okay, let me take the last one first. So there's always an idea, this is actually much more of a live idea in the UK than it is in the US, of why can't Buffalo, New York, or Detroit be a reasonable substitute for housing in New York City or Miami? And this is not all that plausible that Liverpool is going to be a great substitute for London in terms of housing, but it's infinitely more plausible than Detroit will be a reasonable substitute for New York. The economic distance is enormous, right? The climate difference is enormous, right? Remember, sort of, America, unlike the south of England, has huge climate differences. And there is no variable that better predicts metropolitan area growth during the 20th century in the US than January temperature. And let me tell you what Detroit is really bad on. It's really bad on January temperature. So I think it's very unlikely that anything that's not, you know, to a certain extent, Philadelphia can provide a little bit of substitute for New York, but that's the best that you're gonna do. So second one was, go to the first one, Montgomery County. Okay, Montgomery County is, prior to the last 5 years, tends to be in somewhat better shape than, say, Middlesex County, Massachusetts, and I've spent a lot of time in my life in Montgomery County, in part because the zoning is county level. So it's a county level authority, although they still will cater to specific areas. So Olney will be treated differently from Sandy Spring within Montgomery County, even though it's a level thing. All of our areas have, at this point in time, though, a stock of units that have been essentially approved, but they're not starting to build, and that's reflecting rising interest rates. So you had a whole bunch of these areas where, and it doesn't mean that, like, if you could build prefab housing, they would still probably go ahead and do it, but that hasn't been what's approved. What's been approved is kind of a fancy project that kind of penciled in 2019 or 2020, and it doesn't pencil in anymore. And so that's, I think, the situation that you're looking at. And so if the interest rates fall, some of them will get built, others of them will not. And what was the third?
Greenbelt.
Greenbelt. Oh, where's Paul Cheshire when you need
him? No, he's in Japan, actually. He sends his apologies.
What you want to do is figure out how to deliver as much space as possible where demand is high. And so you want to be delivering units in areas where, and I am sure that there are some parts of the Greenbelt that no one's going to miss. And that's probably fine. But I tend to think that, like, you want to be focused as much as possible on kind of high price areas that you think of as being a sort of substitute for, or, you know, Rust Belt areas within closer areas to London. But I, you know, Paul would disown me if I didn't say there's also room to be working on the Green Belt as well.
Right, are there any more online? No? Yes? Take one more online and then we'll take one more upstairs.
How would a quotient payment of outsiders to insiders in a property market work in practice? Are there examples of this working in some settings?
So I know how it would work in practice. Certainly there are things like impact fees that the developers sometimes pay that actually go to the community and that works to help things. Similarly, when there used to be schemes where in Massachusetts, new buildings paid much higher taxes than old buildings, and that was seen as being helpful for getting people to approve new buildings that they were going to pay more. The way that, you know, we would typically do it is have some outside entity essentially compensate the community, some amount of money going to someone locally and some amount of money going to the region as a whole. That gets paid for by developers or perhaps by outside governments as well. That's the sort of way in which it works.
Right, last one, I'm afraid. We might have 10 minutes afterwards before I have to whisk Ed away, so you might get your chance if you come down to the stage. But last one up there.
Hi, I am Miguel from the Masters of Public Policy from Colombia. So we're just studying a case in Mumbai, India, where the supply concentration of housing is mostly in the high income level. Then we have the middle income level that cannot afford housing, and then we have a huge amount of population living in slums. So I'm just wondering if you can share any considerations to overcome this problem.
Well, there we go, affordable housing, the supply of affordable housing.
Urban inequality, and I want to sort of say, you know, I want to make my usual point on urban inequality, which is, cities should never apologize for their inequality. Cities have rich people because they're fun places to be rich, And they have poor people because they're less intolerable places to be poor. And they attract poor people with the ability to find a brighter future, with the ability to get around without having a fleet of cars, with the ability to, you know, get better social safety services. You know, Plato wrote in the Republic that every city of whatever size is in reality two cities, one a city of the rich, the other a city of the poor, and they're perpetually at war with one another. The key element is, the key question is whether or not, you know, cities are turning poor children into rich adults. And that's the thing to think about wherever you see it. And certainly in the US, we've seen too many cities that have failed to do that. And so that, to me, is the agenda. And when I think about Mumbai, right, when I think about Dharavi, which is an amazingly vibrant place, right, it's just a place that I sort of admire enormously in terms of the energy of the average citizens, I don't necessarily think that my first order thing is to improve the housing stock. I'm going to think about public health-related investments. I want to think about clean water. And remember, you know, Anup Malani's work finds that 50% of Dharavi residents had gotten COVID by July 2020, right? So the public health thing is real. I want to think about clean water. I want to think about other health-related things. And I want to think about skills and schooling for the kids before I do anything else that's going to be really expensive in terms of housing. And so, like, at a macro level, housing is really important. But if we think about a population like that, focus on human capital, focus on health. Right, those are the most important investments. Do not think you have to build some incredibly fancy area. And by all means, don't engage in a bunch of regulation that says, unless you have this nice high-end house, you can't live in Dharavi. Because they're moving for Dharavi for a good reason. Too often, you see areas come in and they're saying, oh, we've got to tear down all this cheap housing. And what we created that replaces it is much more expensive housing that doesn't provide space for poor people to find a future. And so just be focused on the best way we have for making sure that poor kids get turned into rich kids. And I think I have to end here.
Yeah. Right? Well, so a brilliant moment on which to end. Do you want one final
thing? I do want one final thing, I am, again, so glad that all of you come here. And I see so many young faces, and it makes me very, very happy. And I just want you to remember that, like, you can change the world on this. Right? You can change the world in many different ways. And just don't forget that. Right? We live in a world in which hope should dominate, and hope will dominate. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.